Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Not looking at the world as a strict journalist, but looking at it as a novelist, is you just have to take in all of it. You know, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Ace Atkins is the author of 21 crime novels, including his latest, The Fallen, which features Mississippi detective Quinn Coulson, this time hunting down some bank robbers and, oh, how about a few sex traffickers, too? Atkins doesn't write about the genteel South. I'm Clay Smith, the editor of Kirkus Reviews, and this is Fully Booked, the Kirkus Reviews podcast. Welcome to the show, Ace.
Hey, very good to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. So The Fallen is your seventh thriller starring Sheriff Quinn Coulson. What trouble is he investigating in this new novel?
Well, there's always different sides to the trouble. There's, you know, there's personal and then there's professional. Right. But on the professional side of this, it starts off with a team of bank robbers arriving in this small county in Mississippi. And they hit town and they have decided to rob a bank, but this time in a kind of an unusual fashion. They're dressed up like Donald Trump. And I can't really go here. I'm not sure exactly what the standards are on a podcast, but one of them actually shoots a gun into the air and says, if anyone moves, I'm going to grab them by the... And I can't say it.
Right.
And that's in the first three pages of the book. Yeah. So lots of trouble for Quinn Coulson in this one.
Right. And what about personally? What's going on with him personally?
Well, I mean, the books are really kind of a mixture of, you know, they're certainly crime novels, but they're a lot about Quinn Coulson's own life. They're about him dealing with issues in his family, his mother, his sister. Sister has substance abuse issues, you know, his love life, the greater good of the community. And so it's kind of a Southern dysfunctional family drama mixed in with, you know, a little bit of crime as well.
Yeah. And his mom, Jean Coulson, always seems to show up at just the wrong moment to like twist the knife about his embarrassing love life. And
just like a good mother should, you know, if you don't have a good Southern mother to twist the knife in you and show up at the wrong time, then what good are you?
So what year was the first Quinn Coulson
The first book came out in 2011. It's called The Ranger. And then this particular book is number seven.
Yeah. Do you remember back in, well, I guess it would have been 2009 or something when you were writing, how did the idea of, a Southern sheriff as your protagonist come to you?
Yeah. And it's funny. Somebody brought this point up the other day, which is that, you know, sometimes Southern sheriffs aren't exactly the most popular people in the world. You know, there's a very negative connotation with the Southern sheriff. Right. But, you know, of course, this is the modern South. This is the new South. But my longtime publisher, G.P. Putnam, my editor there, a terrific guy named Neil Nyron, asked me if I'd be interested in writing a series. And at that time, I was not necessarily interested in writing a series. I was writing some what we call true crime novels, novels based on true stories. I did a book about Machine Gun Kelly in 1933. I did one about the Fatty Arbuckle scandal in 1921. And so I was really doing these kind of broad scope, big crime novels. But it was an intriguing idea. And I was very interested to see what it would be like to return to one character and to one world and see what I could do with that. And it wasn't really until I came up with an idea about the larger community that Quinn lives in did it really set that I could do something different and unusual. I was not interested in just doing the protagonist, the hero with the gun and the brooding hero who sleeps with different women each time and has these special skills and all that. I really wanted to do something about an everyday guy in his own community and really have what I'd call almost like a Robert Altman ensemble cast. Mm-hmm. And that's once I kind of had that in mind and I had an idea to do it in North Mississippi, I thought, boy, this could be fun.
Yeah, yeah. The question I always ask when I interview a writer who writes a series where you are repeatedly returning to the same characters, and in particular, you know, one protagonist, as you have with Quinn Coulson, is what made you think in the beginning that this guy was interesting enough that you would want to spend potentially the rest of your life writing about?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. And it wasn't the idea that I could spend the rest of my life just writing about Quinn Coulson and imagining what the different stories would be. It was writing about this county and mm-hmm. writing about Tippecanoe County, Mississippi,
right.
and writing about the corruption and the politics and the family dynamics and the history. And I thought that that really was, I had a very open ending to doing all kinds of stories. And right. I thought that this could be something very exciting. And it really comes from my love of two things, which is classic crime fiction and Raymond Chandler and then William Faulkner.
Mm-hmm.
And getting to explore this little section of Mississippi, this rural southern county, it gave me a lot of, it was very exciting. It was an exciting idea to be able to see what's going to happen next.
Right, right. I mean, I've been to Oxford. It's a beautiful place, great bookstores, interesting restaurants. Your depiction of the county, at least in this latest novel, The Fallen, you know, is not so rosy.
Yeah, and it's not Oxford.
Right. Down the road, right?
Yeah, it's a little, okay. it's maybe a lot down the road from Oxford. Oxford's really kind of an oasis in Mississippi.
Right.
It's a college town, has a beautiful town square, a lot of history, a lot of literary history, beautiful,
yeah.
one of the best bookstores in the country, all that great stuff.
Yeah.
It's Square Books. But Tippecanoe County is more like a lot of the rural counties. In fact, it's really based on like three or four counties that are in and around Oxford.
Yeah.
And so it is a different world. It is not a college town. It is not
right.
a place filled with, you know, academics and moneyed people as Oxford,
right.
Mississippi is. It's a,
right.
it's a hard scrabble county. I mean, but it's filled with all kinds of, you know, the highs and lows of society.
Yeah. And you call the town Jericho. And so, I mean, would you say that you sort of do research, on really what is happening in those smaller towns in
Mississippi? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, almost every single Quinn Colson book that I've done, and it, you know, I always talk about that, talk about Quinn Colson book. Really, I guess probably more fair would be talking about a Tippecanoe County book because
right.
he is a very pivotal character, but he's only one of the characters that
yeah.
makes up the cast. But usually they spin off an actual event. And
mm-hmm.
so I'm always looking at the newspaper. I'm always listening to buddies that are either in the, you know, the courthouse or they're in the law enforcement profession that come up with these ideas or have these stories. And almost all of them begin with something that actually happened. And I'm
mm-hmm.
a former journalist. I used to be a newspaper reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really like that. I really want to make these books as authentic as possible.
Right. You know, you live in Oxford, which, as you said, you know, is sort of a, I guess, better standard of living in general than
sure.
these smaller...
Probably the nicest in the state.
Yeah. Do you ever get gruff from local residents, whether they're in Oxford or these smaller towns,
yeah.
about depicting
yeah.
the region in the way that you do, or...?
Well, I have, yes, a couple times I've heard from people. Oftentimes don't like certain things that I mention. And I'm very fair, you know, I like to write about, I could sit here and tell you all the wonderful things about being in Mississippi or where I'm originally from in Alabama.
Right.
You know, the food and the music and the people and the culture is just fantastic. But any of those people who have contacted me to complain have never denied that the stories are authentic. And do they actually happen? And are all these real people?
Right.
And I was really fascinated recently, you know, it's interesting sitting here talking on a podcast is like recently listening to S-Town
uh-huh.
and hearing that depiction of the South.
Yeah.
And like it or not, it's about as accurate as you get.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the same approach. Not looking at the world as a strict journalist, but looking at it as a novelist is you just have to take in all of it, you know, the
yeah.
good, the bad, and the ugly.
Right.
And as a novelist, I try to kind of encompass the same thing and the same open mind
mm-hmm.
As I did when I was a reporter. And if
right.
they don't like it, they don't like what how it is. And if it's not just, you know, people often write about the South and it's either, you know, steel magnolias or it's Mississippi burning. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, it kind of is somewhere in between.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So even just a sort of a casual accounting after having read The Fallen, it sort of made it clear to me that in order to write this one, you needed to research how to rob a bank effectively.
Sure.
The Dixie Mafia, the details of sex trafficking, and the psychology and sort of consequences of suffering from PTSD. First of all, is that accurate?
Sure. Yeah, no, it is. Yeah. It is. And I, you know, I start with all that stuff before I start writing. And it's not something I don't feel comfortable just, you know, making that stuff up. I really do enjoy the research and talking to people and
right.
you know, falling short of robbing a bank. I try to do everything I can to prepare to
yeah.
rob a bank.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so your internet history must be pretty intriguing.
Yes.
I'm guessing.
Yeah. You know, sometimes when I'm doing that, you know, if I'm looking up certain things of, you know, you're typing in bank robbery plans or, you know, bank, you know. who's looking at this stuff? Is anyone watching my back? And am I now being monitored? No, I'm not paranoid about it. But I did end up talking to a lot of people who are professionals and people who've been in law enforcement. And I got a buddy who's an ex-federal agent, and we sat down and had lunch, and we, you know, he had a scheme of how it would work. And I got another buddy who's an Army veteran. And I said, look, I said, with your Army training, I said, I'm a former newspaper reporter. I am not a former Army guy. I'm not a military guy. You know, I'm not skilled with a gun. What would you do? Mm-hmm. And we sit down and plan this stuff out over cocktails. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. All of those topics sounds like so much fun to research. So how do you,
all except for the sex trafficking, that was not a joke. Yeah.
We should clarify that. Yeah. But you know, how do you be self-disciplined enough to tell yourself, okay, I know enough, the research is done, and now I've like got to sit down and write this novel?
Well, that's a good question, because that's something I go through with every book, which is I really, as a former newspaper reporter, I love the research. I love doing the interviews. I could sit down and do this all the time. I could sit and talk to these people. I could do, but I have to realize I'm not writing a feature article on modern day bank robbing. I'm not writing a large magazine story dealing with sex trafficking. I'm not writing about this stuff. I really just have to know it just enough. And, you know, that's really what, as I get to be an older writer, and I've been doing this now for almost 20 years, mm-hmm. I do feel like there's a point where I say, okay, I got it. I understand it. And, you know, I try to do it effectively and quickly and then get to the story. But unless I have those details, unless I have it, I don't feel comfortable writing it. It's more about getting confidence. Once I have the confidence that I understand the subject matter, then I can start writing.
Yeah. And then when you're done, do you have people like this federal agent read over those technical details for you to make sure you got them right? Or
I just write ahead. And if I make a mistake, then I said, just don't tell me. I don't want to know. If I've done a good job, tell me. If I screwed something up, I said completely, it's my fault.
Right, right. So the bank robbers in The Fallen are former soldiers who get away with their crimes in part because everyone in the South assumes they're do-gooders since they served their country.
Sure.
And, you know, you're doing something interesting in The Fallen, I think, where you question our tendency as Americans to sort of idolize soldiers without really thinking twice about whether that's wise. For example, there's one character in this novel, I think a federal agent, who says, killing folks doesn't make you a hero.
Yeah.
So was it difficult to sort of toe that line?
Well, I think that, you know, post 9/11, I think we had the tendency in society to, you know, everybody is a hero. If you're a cop, firefighter, and if you're in the military, everybody's a hero. It's just that we quickly reacted in that way. And as we know, moving on from that time, that's not necessarily the case. Now, look, wonderful people work in law enforcement, men and women, wonderful people, men and women working in the military. I have nothing but high respect for them. And it certainly is not it's just that when you have a group of that large of a people, you're going to have some bad apples in that group. Right. The story that actually facilitated The Fallen, the idea of it, was about a couple of U.S. Army Rangers who were active duty outside Seattle, Washington about 2 or 3 years ago that robbed a bank. Mm. And I thought it was just absolutely fascinating. And I thought,
is this that book that's going to be out in the fall by Ben Bloom?
I don't know. Maybe so. It's certainly I could have written a nonfiction book about it, but
there were
a couple guys out in Seattle working out of Fort Lewis. And I thought, who better to rob a bank than somebody with military training?
Right.
And, you know, when I used to cover law enforcement, I would frequently cover bank robberies. And most people who rob banks really are not that skilled at it. You know, it's not the Thomas Crown Affair. It's not the Stopwatch Gang. I mean, these people are not that good at what they do. I mean, one time I covered a bank robber who walked in and he had a salad fork with him, and that's how he demanded to get his money. So I thought, you know, if you're really going to do this, you're going to do it effectively. Who's the best to do it? And it's people who can get in a situation, control it very quickly.
Yeah.
Get out of it, get out with the money.
Right.
And this day and age, it's going to be military trained people.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is a book coming out on September 12th called Ranger Games. And the subtitle is A Story of Soldiers, Family, and an Inexplicable Crime. And I think it's this case that you
it's
are talking
about. It's a fascinating
case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the robbers actually is actually Canadian, and there was some problem with extradition with him. And you talk about researching, then having to stop. Really got into that true story of how these Rangers got into robbing banks. But then I had to stop myself, and I realized I'm not writing about them. I'm writing about people who are like them.
Right, right, right. You know, so one thing to admire about this novel, The Fallen, is that, you know, you put a lot of work, I can tell, into creating characters who are really complex people. Mm. You don't really have any characters who are all bad or all good. Maybe Skinner. He's really hard to
Skinner
like.
Skinner is a very, very difficult person, for
yeah,
sure.
And yeah. For people who haven't read the novel, we should say that Skinner is sort of a pious fundamentalist, I guess, who yeah. is elected county commissioner.
He's in what they call county supervisors, but essentially the same thing, county commissioner. And he wants to make Tibahaw County a more godly place, and he says he wants to make it the way it used to be back in the 1950s, mm-hmm. which he has a very clouded memory of what depending on what group you were in, the 1950s were not the best of times.
Right, right. So obviously, you know, it's sort of the name of the game when you're a novelist to create characters who are not all good or all bad, right?
Sure.
But it was particularly in your depiction of Fanny Hathcock, who is this strip club owner, you know, who tries to take care of the girls who work at her strip club. Although she's very tough with them also. Mm. She does some terrible, terrible things in this novel, but I still kind of liked her.
Do you?
Now
I'm understanding a lot about you. Now we're getting this.
Is it ever tempting to make someone like her all bad?
I don't think so. And I think, you know, that's sometimes I think what separates, if you really break down things as far as like crime fiction and just a broad thriller. And, you know, broad thriller seems to be very fast paced and black and white characters and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, the noir, the crime novel is really understanding those people. And certainly for me to be able to write Fanny, and again, she is as important of a character and equal footing as Quinn Colson in this book and in her story. And when she's going through this particular story, I have to have empathy for her. I have to understand her motivations. And, you know, frequently people do not think they're bad people. The prisons are filled with those kind of people. They think they're doing the right thing for the right reasons.
Right.
And it's important as a novelist that I understand what those reasons are.
Yeah. And so do you, in addition to this earlier research that we talked about, do you ask to interview criminals in jail to ask them about that kind of thing?
No, I just, I just go to the strip clubs all the time and I talk to
them. Right.
Yeah, I don't know why. My accountant says we can't write this stuff off. I'm not sure. You know, I have interviewed a lot of criminals, I kind of have it. I don't need to go and interview criminals anymore. When I was a newspaper reporter, back when I was in my 20s, I used to go to jails and interview people and cover court trials and that kind of thing. But, you know, I understand Fanny. I mean, Fanny is something that I understand as a person. I don't have to necessarily understand her as a businesswoman, but I understand where she's come from and how she has developed such a tough skin that she does the things that she has to do. And I understand why she's kind of a really rough-edged Scarlett O'Hara. I mean, she is never going to go hungry again. And I can sympathize with her plight.
Yeah. But I mean, and you sort of make her human in a one way that you do that is that, you know, you briefly depict that she had a really terrible upbringing.
Sure. Yeah.
But that still doesn't really redeem her, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there are some unredeemable acts that happen in this book that when we knew her from the earlier novels, I think she was a little bit easier to follow, but I think there's a line that's crossed here it's hard to go back.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting to me in this novel set in the Deep South, where in real life in the Deep South, you know, religion is so important.
Sure.
That you don't really give this county supervisor, Skinner, any points for being religious.
Well, I mean, let's face it though, you know, usually the most pious and the folks that are, you know, really, really, really sanctimonious, they always fall the farthest. Right. They really do. You know, just yesterday it was announced the head football coach at Ole Miss, who is known for tweeting Bible verses continuously all day long. And he would instead of talking about football, he would give Bible sermons, all that. Well, of course, he resigned yesterday because he was making phone calls to a prostitute. And, you know, so those people that, you know, have to tell you what a great person they are, and they have to tell you what a godly person they are. And they, look, whether you're in Texas, whether you're in the South, we know these people. And it happens again and again, and you can see it from a mile away. But Skinner, yes, certainly are those people. But, you know, I don't have contempt for religion, and I don't have – I mean, there are characters that are in the book that really do lead that life, and they're not motivated by power or money or stature or whatever. Yeah. And one of those is Quinn's sister, Caddy, and she has been in her life with drugs and alcohol and men and just everything. She has gotten about as a low a point as a human can get, and she has come back from that. I mean, she's a, it's a true redemption story where she's headed, and she's intertwined with actually helping people, and she just wants to feed people, help people, help people get there on their feet. I mean, she's like the real embodiment of that, but does not get credit for it, and neither wants it.
Yeah, we sort of have the two poles of religious behavior, I guess, in this novel.
It's deeds, you know, it's one person talking about it, and then it's actually a person living the life.
Right,
and that's
right.
really what they represent.
Yeah.
You know?
And you have this really interesting, I guess we could call it a church, in the novel it's called The River.
Yeah.
And it seems sort of like a barn-like kind of structure, I guess.
Sure.
I mean, interestingly, you know, you don't write about the sermons at this place called the River. You really write about the details of, you know, getting people fed, giving clothes away, all that kind of stuff. Is that based on a real, on an actual church in...
You know, no, I wish there was a place like that. I mean, we certainly could need that. We certainly could use that. There are places, even in the county that I mentioned where I live, there are places that are very, very nice, very exclusive shops. Like I think then there are parts of the county where people are living in dwellings that are just, you know, plywood and corrugated tin slapped together, and they really do need help. But really what that place represented is, again, people doing like truly living that life, not just cloaking themselves in religion or wearing a t-shirt or, you know, whatever, or professing that they're these kind of things. It's actually, if they are really going to live that life, what kind of person, what would they actually do? And I think they would kind of work in that capacity, working to clothe people, to feed people, help them get on their feet, and also working with the lowest of the low. I mean, not just hobnobbing with people you want to, you know, have chatter with, but actually going out into the community and helping people. And there are people like that. I mean, there certainly are, but nothing on that I know about that is works in the same way as Caddy's particularly work at the river.
Yeah, and it's admirable, definitely. You know, do you have a sense of what, either from just sort of anecdotally from your readings and events that you do, or even, you know, harder data from your publisher, whether you have more men who are reading you or women?
You know, I don't know. I mean, it's just so hard. I mean, I have got kind of anecdotal evidence just from book signings and people that I hear from, or people who, you know, that I'll come in contact with. I mean, I would probably say most of my readers are probably women. I think that that's just the fact of any books.
Yeah.
I think that it's just mainly women have the patience and the intelligence to actually sit down and read a book, as opposed to men who, you know, maybe occasionally will read a book, but often, you know, fall asleep on the couch watching SportsCenter. But I do have a lot of, you know, great fans that are men that do like books and get it. So I shouldn't totally rule out men.
Right. Yeah. You know, when I'm reading a novel, it's rare that I think, oh, my dad would like this. Because as you said, I think, you know, a lot of the readers in this country are women. But this novel has details of AR-15, assault rifles, and...
Which I'm not really, you know, I'm not really into. Either.
Right.
You know, I'm not, you know, but... the
You're not a hunter?
No. I couldn't do it. Yeah.
So didn't you have two books out this year?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how is that possible?
I drink a lot of coffee. I have to live a pretty disciplined life. I don't take a lot of time off. I don't do a lot of book conferences. I don't do a lot of book signings, that kind of thing. I do the book signings that my publisher asked me to do, and then I get back to work. But I'm working all the time. There's no sabbaticals. There's no time off. There's no extended vacations. I don't know how much longer I can do that on a two-book-a-year schedule. But for right now, I think from working in a busy city newsroom, I still have that discipline to continue to go into work and write every day. But yeah, it's not easy.
But it must be more difficult for you because the Quinn Colson series, I mean, you're writing, you know, presumably in your own voice.
Sure.
Or yeah, at least a narrative voice that you have developed yourself. But you have been hired to write the Parker novels, Robert B. Parker's.
Yeah, Robert Parker's family hired me shortly after his death.
And so you're really hired to write kind of as well as you can in someone else's voice.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Does that ever become a schizophrenic situation for you?
You know, as long as I stay my meds, it all works out fine. You know, the voices kind of subside. It is a little schizophrenic. It's a little bit complicated. And even though the books that I'm writing, the Quinn books, are, I would say, technically more complicated because they involve all types of different characters and usually a much more complex story. Mm-hmm. It's often more difficult going to write the Spencer books because I'm going through that added layer. It's not just what Spencer is going to do. It's making a decision as what Robert B. Parker might do to have that character do it. But I look at it as not a constraining thing, but more of a challenge. And I think it's kind of like a puzzle. It's kind of fun. It's kind of it's not constraining. It's more of a, for a writer that I really admired a great deal. It's a lot of fun for me. I wouldn't do this. You know, I wouldn't take on a job to write for anybody else. There's nobody else, but I had such a close personal connection. I did not know him personally, but as a young man reading those books, that it influenced the kind of books that I wanted to write. So he really was a hero to me. So I really take it seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. Last question. You've written a sort of classic cliffhanger at the very end of The Fallen.
Yeah.
When does the next Quinn Colson novel come out? And can you give us any hints about what's going to happen?
You know, I think in the Quinn books, I mean, I'll say very quickly is that, you know, I like that each book shows a different story about Tippahaw County. And I don't mean just a different tale, but an evolution of that world, an evolution of Caddy's life and Quinn's life and even old man Skinner. You know, God knows, I hope something really horrible happens to him. he's such a pious SOB. Yeah. But I think that what's kind of developed in the Quinn books, I think what's really brought readers to them and starting to, people are very curious about that is usually the last chapter is usually the first chapter of the next book. And so I think I can't tell you exactly what's going to happen in the next book. To be cryptic about it because it's mainly because I don't know myself.
Right.
I'm not really sure until once I get into it. But I think that there's certainly events at the end of The Fallen that are game changers. And it's for me, it's in writing something like these books. And you asked me at the very beginning of this interview, you know, is it constraining to write about the same character over and over again? But again, you know, from the idea of writing about this world and this county and these people, it's very much kind of like watching long series arc television, like watching Deadwood. And I love that show. I loved watching Deadwood. And I like to see how things changed and the political alliances and who was coming in, who was going to die, who was going to live, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So that's what excites me about finding out what's going to happen. And as I said, I'm not really sure.
Great. Well, we will look for the next one. Nice job on this one.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming by.
My pleasure.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked. Hey, have you heard? Podcast One has a whole bunch of awesome new shows filled with big names that are waiting for you on our brand new, amazing app. This one's a game changer. There's Norman Lear talking to Amy Poehler, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and Charles Barkley. Geffen Playhouse Unscripted with Bryan Cranston, Josh Gad, and soon, Neil Patrick Harris.
Nice.
OC Real Housewife Heather Dubrow's World. Lady Gang's Three Mimosa Podcast with Leah Michelle, Nelly Furtado, Elle King, and more. Plus, every episode of The Adam Carolla Show, Dan Patrick, and Rich Eisen. And if you like what happens in the ring, we've got Steve Austin, Chris Jericho, Chael Sonnen, and a whole bunch more. So download our one of a kind new app and see for yourself. Go to the App Store, Google Play, or download it now at podcastone.com. This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
Jardine the Bear's white fur is white hot right now. An incendiary love story set in New Haven and New York in the gritty mid-80s. White Fur was published by Hogarth on May 30th and met with considerable critical acclaim. This week, it's back in the news with two notable items. One, as an enthusiastic reading recommendation from Sarah Jessica Parker, and two, as a news item in Variety magazine, in which Film Nation Entertainment announced the sale of a one-hour TV drama series based on the book to Amazon Studios. Jardine, welcome to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Are you currently drinking champagne?
No, I should be. It's been such a good week.
Let's start with Sarah Jessica Parker's online video with Read It Forward. In recommending your book, she says something along the lines of, if Jay McInerney and Bret Easton Ellis married and created a child and then, you know, basically beamed her back into the time when they were writing to also write, she would give them a run for their money. What was it like to receive that praise?
I think I started laughing because it was just too good. I mean, that's the stuff of like teenage dreams, you know? That was kind of miraculous to hear. And from her, who's just one of those amazing New York City heroines that just stands high above, you know, everyone in my mind as who she is in reality and then who she is as a character too. I mean, she's just awesome. So,
that's so exciting. I've now heard her describe your book to me. How would you describe White Fur to our listeners?
My little elevator pitch is that it is a transgressive but tender kind of Romeo and Juliet 1980s New York City story that has a lot to do with class in America. But at the baseline, it's still a story about kind of young love and lust and what it means to be 20.
Oh, my. That time. I remember it a little too well for my own comfort. So this book centers around a couple of young lovers. There's Elise Perez and Jamie Hyde. I think of them as a rather incongruous couple. Would you please tell our listeners about their respective backgrounds?
They are incongruous. That's a perfect word.
Thanks.
She grew up in subsidized housing in Bridgeport. And her mother is white and her father is Puerto Rican. And she never really belonged to any community as she was growing up. She was kind of an outsider. Jamie grew up in sort of epic wealth, the 1% of the 1% on the Upper East Side of New York. And he is a junior at Yale. And they end up living next door to each other in New Haven. And hopefully that sets the platform for a kind of plausible way from people from completely different universes to meet. She didn't get to finish high school, whereas he has had the highest level of schooling his whole life. They've seen different things. They've believed in different things. So when they meet, they really are coming from opposite planets.
One of the things that you do so well in this book is give us little glimpses into the specific people that they are. About Elise, you write, Elise never separates things into day and night, rarely thinks about being a boy or girl, or alive or dead. Without divisions, there's less work to do. She floats free in a cheap and magic way. And about Jamie, you write, somehow he gives the impression of being a hustler, but also being the mark. His self twisted into a Mobius strip of innate glamour and his own exploitation. First of all, the writing's beautiful. It's notably beautiful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to read. But what's so interesting is that you have people from such disparate backgrounds who do come together in this authentic way. And I mean, Jamie initially, with his background, wonders if he's even capable of that kind of romantic love and devotion to another person.
Definitely. Yeah, I think one of the keys to what happens between them is that Elise, even though she did not grow up with material wealth, did grow up with a really intense and kind of sacred bond to her mother, who was a really good mother despite a lot of odds that were against her. So Elise has this strong capacity for love and also for being vulnerable. And Jamie was raised by nannies. His parents had a really acrimonious divorce when he was little. And he grew up with everything material that a child could dream of. And he doesn't think he has that capacity. So they are on a journey to see what one person can do for another, I think.
I agree. And so part of their actual journey is Jamie invites Elise to come with him to New York. He's staying in a wealthy friend of the family's apartment for the summer, and he has an internship at an auction house, and she moves in with him. Why New York? What do you love about it? And specifically in the 80s?
What is not to love, I guess.
Right?
I think for me, I grew up on Long Island, mm-hmm. and I started going into the city occasionally when I turned 13 by myself. And I think that would have been the year that this book takes place, in 1986. Mm-hmm. And it just made such a massive and deep impression on me as a magnificent place, as a terrifying place, as a baffling place where there was such opulence and then there were people lying on the sidewalk that could be dead. Mm-hmm. And I think because I saw that with my little 13-year-old, don't know yet what's going on, brain, it made a particularly extraordinary impact. So that's a kind of wealth of perception, whatever you experience, I think, as a young teen, that is great to dig into in your writing. And then I also just thought New York in the mid-80s, in the Reagan era, was a fabulous, you know, microculture to look at class in America. And I started this book about 6 years ago, so to be honest, I thought that it was something that would be less in the mainstream dialogue.
Wow.
And I think what has happened in our country is that it's more in the mainstream dialogue, this issue of class and disparity, than I thought it was when I thought I was reaching back to something that was exotic, but a little bit more distant than it feels now.
That's what's so crazy and beautiful about books, right? You do only to a very certain extent have a say in when your book is going to come out. You don't have any say in what the world is going to be like then. And to write a book set in the mid-80s that has such a timeliness today is just remarkable.
It's weird and it's a little bit upsetting, but yeah, it is interesting to sort of trace how a book then meets, like you said, its publication moment, which you don't have control over.
Well, our reviewer wrote very, very favorably about the novel. And there's this quote from the review: "The real strength of the novel is its technicolor atmosphere. There's New York is a glittering whirlwind, raw and sweaty and intoxicating," which I agree with. And I love that our reviewer wrote that. But to really home in on technicolor, the book is called White Fur. You've got a color in the title. And throughout, I noticed a lot of these colors, white and black and blood red and gold. And I was just wondering, did you have like a color palette that you were conceiving of when you were writing this book? Or?
Oh, that's such a good question.
Thank you.
Think it probably evolved. I looked at tons and tons of photographs.
Mm.
And tons of footage from the 80s on YouTube, like a lot of home footage and,
yeah,
you know, street photography style footage. And probably that palette comes from what I just organically was putting back into the story from looking at. And then it also probably, as these things do, you know, correlates to something deeper in the story. I mean, the fact that it is technicolor sometimes, I think, mm-hmm. reflects this desire to see like a bigger than life story and something that is almost psychedelic. And then yeah, the black and white, you know, always, I think, can stand for divisions and sides, which is certainly relevant to this story too.
Absolutely. So thinking visually now, I think that's probably a good segue for us to talk about this TV series with Film Nation Entertainment. Mm-hmm. First, congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you.
You wrote the adaptation and are a co-executive producer. Is that correct?
Yes, which is so fun.
Yeah. What's this been like?
It has been To be honest, a completely positive and totally creative experience so far. And I've, you know, heard horror stories about novelists who go into this world and really feel like they can't do what they do best, or they feel compromised or blocked. And the book was optioned right after it was sold by FilmNation. And I think they just had this idea that was in sync with the book itself. So they let me adapt it without having to tame it or trim it in ways that didn't feel true.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the director, Drake Doremus, attached from the very beginning. And his vision is also, I think, just naturally in sync with FilmNation and with the book itself. So I don't know if it was just luck, but we have been able to develop the series and then find a home for it at Amazon in a way that just felt good. I mean, it's laborious going through so many different stages with so many people as opposed to writing a novel, which is completely solitary.
Sure.
And it's definitely a different model of creation, you know, to be working with different people in these early stages, but so far it's been great.
I am so happy for you. That sounds amazing.
You.
And I'm excited to see it when it comes out. I can't wait.
Yeah, thank you. Me too.
I always, as a reader, like, you know, love the creative, I love the work that I bring to reading, you know, and the helping to, you know, fulfill this author's vision of this world. And I love to see how discordant, you know, a television show is. Like, I want to see my Jamie and my Elise, you know, held up against the actors that get to play them. It's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting. We'll see. a lot of open questions, that's for sure.
Well, that I think is the perfect place for us to stop today. I want to thank you again for taking the time out to join us on Fully Booked.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you again so much for having me on.
If you're looking for a great new book to read, this is, of course, the perfect podcast for you. We also have a little advice for you about buying a new car. It's from TrueCar. In order to feel comfortable that you're getting a fair price, you need pricing context, information that empowers you to feel confident. With TrueCar, you'll see what other people in your local market paid for the car you want. From there, you can connect with a local TrueCar certified dealer and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. TrueCar will show you what other people in your area paid for the car you want. Now you know what a fair price is, so you can feel confident. Once you register, you'll see real pricing on actual inventory. This is competitive pricing offered to you only by a TrueCar certified dealer for an actual vehicle on their lot. It's pricing you'll see before going to a dealership, so you can feel confident when you show up. With TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing, so you can enjoy a quick, easy buying experience. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with TrueCar certified dealers. TrueCar users save an average of over $3,000 off manufacturer suggested retail price. There are over 13,000 TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. So when you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
Well, listeners, it's our favorite time of the podcast where we ask our editors to join us for a rousing round of Buy It, Skip It for the week. Joining us today are fiction editor Lori Muchnick and children's editor Vicky Smith. Our managing editor and nonfiction editor, Eric Liebetrau, is on vacation for the week. Let's please start with Vicky. The Jeopardy champion of our hearts. Hey, Vicky.
Of our hearts, but not of reality, perhaps.
You came so close. Like,
How many people can say that? Lots and lots of people can say that.
For our listeners who may have missed it, Vicky was on Jeopardy not too long ago and came just so close to defeating. Was he the reigning champion of the week?
It was his third day, yes.
How do you feel post-match?
Basically fine. I don't know why it occurred to me, it didn't occur to me that being on nationally broadcast television, albeit syndicated, wouldn't attract attention, but a lot more people have been talking about it than I ever expected to. So
Did you see it, Lori?
I did, and it was really fun seeing you on TV, Vicki, and I thought you were great.
Well, thank you.
We always thought you were great, but now everybody knows what we know. So that out of the way, Vicki, please, what is your top pick in children's literature for the week?
Well, a book that has just recently hit the bestseller list is not new. It's from 2015, but it is fabulous. It's called Mother Bruce, and it's by Ryan T. Higgins. And it's a picture book about a very, very crabby bear named Bruce. He steals eggs from his neighbors. That's how he feeds himself. Eggs are just the best thing as far as he's concerned. But he accidentally steals some goose eggs that are on the verge of hatching. And they, in fact, do hatch when he gets them home and they imprint on him.
Oh.
And,
I was really identifying closely with this. I can be a grumpy bear and I love eggs, but at that point it really threw me for a loop. Please go on.
Okay. Well, it threatens to become very, very cute at that point, because what is cuter than geese imprinting on a bear? but Higgins manages to keep it very wry and very funny throughout, because Bruce resists parenthood as best he can. At one point, he actually puts a pat of butter on top of one of the gosling's heads. And then, of course, and so the geese stay. They stay with Mother Bruce. They go from annoying baby geese through stubborn teenage geese wearing headphones into boring adult geese. And they don't even migrate. They just live fairly grumpily ever after. It's really funny. It's got this very, very wry, understated text and hysterical illustrations. And there's a sequel for people who like that called Hotel Bruce, in which Bruce is still a curmudgeon.
So what's the age range audience for this?
We recommended 3 to 6. You have to have a kid who's old enough to get a sense of the irony so that they understand what is funny about it. Mm-hmm. So I would say on the older edge of 3, not just turned 3-year-olds, but older to 3, and then actually probably even higher than 6, because it would be a very funny read aloud in primary grades, I think.
Okay, cool. What didn't you like this week?
Well, this is the time of year when there are a lot of back-to-school books out. And as with a lot of books that seem to be made for an occasion, a lot of them aren't great. One that may well get some attention because it's illustrated by James Dean, who does the Pete the Cat books, which are very popular. That he does the illustration. The writer is Joan Holub, who is an industry veteran. She's got a ton of books to her name. And this one just isn't one of their best. It's a bunch of tools who go to school and they have to learn how to cooperate in order to build successfully. And that is all true, but it makes for a fairly didactic story. And the tools don't have much variation in expression. They're either sort of unhappy or happy. So it just kind of sits there, we found.
Can I ask what they build, or is that giving away too much of the ending? Sorry. You heard it, listeners. You heard it here first. Not recommended, sadly. But thank you, Vicki. We appreciate your knowledge.
You're welcome.
Okay, moving to fiction. Hey, Lori.
Hey, Megan. I have something a little different this week, which is I have a recommendation and an avoid, an anti-recommendation of books by the same author.
Oh, my gosh. This has never happened in fully booked history. I'm ready.
Well, I guess not that many people have books on the bestsellers for over a year, you know, so by the time their next book comes out, they still have a book on the list. So this writer is Ruth Ware. She writes psychological suspense novels. This is her third book. First one came out 2 years ago, so she's written one every summer for the last 3 summers. And the one that is new that has just come out this year is called The Lying Game. Mm-hmm. And our reviewer thought that this is her best book yet. It's not an unusual setup. In fact, I think I anti-recommended a book with a similar setup a few weeks ago. It's about four women who were in boarding school together 15 years ago and something terrible happened. And, you know, now in the present, the first person narrator, Issa, gets a text no name. She did, you know, a number that doesn't look familiar to her. And it just says, I need you. And she knows exactly who this is from and what's it about. It's from her friend Kate, who lives down by the coast in England where they went to school. Kate's father had been a teacher at the school, and she still lives in this small coastal town. And so the next day, Issa picks up her newborn baby daughter and tells her husband, I'm going to visit this old school friend. And two other friends have gotten the same text from Kate. So they all go down there and they find that a bone has been found in the water. Clearly, this is something to do with them, something that happened 15 years ago when they were back at school. There are intimations that they had to leave school unceremoniously. You know, you don't find out for a long time what happened, but you switch back and forth between the present and this Issa's really engaging first person narration of, you know, trying to figure out what's going on and, you know, how should she approach what might come if people find out what they did way back then. And then also kind of flashbacks to their life in school. It's full of psychological suspense, but there's a very slow unraveling of the tension. And our reviewer felt that this really elevated it above her other books. It never develops into melodrama. It's very grounded in the character of the narrator and the character of her friends. So a really intriguing, intense read.
That sounds awesome. So are we to avoid her sophomore novel? Or?
Well, her sophomore novel is called The Woman in Cabin 10. And it came out last summer and it's still on the bestseller list. So maybe you've already read it. I'd be curious to hear what our listeners thought about it, if they've already read it. But if you haven't, you know, go for the new one. Don't go for this one. The Woman in Cabin 10 is another sort of classic setup, a sort of paranoid woman story. Again, not entirely original. There's a travel journalist who goes on a cruise and she hears what sounds like a splash in the water outside her window. And she becomes convinced that the woman in the cabin next to her went overboard. Mm-hmm. But then it turns out there was no one booked into the cabin next to her. But she had met the woman in the cabin next to her and borrowed something from her before they went to dinner that night. So everyone is trying to make her think she's crazy, or she begins to think she is crazy and trying to figure out what happened. So it is actually a good setup and the book is good, but unfortunately it doesn't end well, which when you're a suspense novel, that kind of to some degree blows the whole book in a way. So if you're looking, you know, it's not like it's a terrible book, but if you want to read one of her books, go for the new one.
And the first, am I remembering correctly that her first book was the inaugural title for Scout Press as a new imprint?
You have a good memory. It was called In a Dark, Dark Wood. Came out in 2015, and it was the first book by this new press, Scout Press, and they put a lot of promotional heft behind it, and they've published all of her books so far, so they're really kind of creating her career, which is always nice to see in publishing, to see a house get behind a writer.
Right on.
Yeah.
Okay. So now that we have all of the pertinent information, we know what to read, what to avoid, it's time to turn off your device and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
There are 120,000 unsolved murder cases in America.
It was the next day that I found out from my parents what had happened, that my sister was killed.
Each one is called a cold case.
Sometimes you have to look really closely to find the evidence.
Damn it, I killed her.
Damn it, I killed her.
Cold Case Files, the podcast.
Garcia is walking into the home of a real monster.
I was nervous. I realized what kind of person I was dealing with.
It's a goosebump moment.
Download new episodes every Tuesday on the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or podcastone.com.